The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. Our host, Zach Compson, is joined by Kenny Washington, guest vocalist for our Southern Theater series, Nat King Cole and Friends.
Welcome to the Jazz Scene Podcast, Kenny Washington. We're so glad that you're here with us today.
Happy to be here.
So you were here with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, and you're doing a Nat King Cole themed show, although I assume that there's maybe some other music that will sort of round that out. But I want to just learn more about you, as we were just talking off mic. So many of our peers have heard you sing by now, Todd Stoll, our good friend in New York, and of course Byron Stripling. And, you know, it's listening to some videos and your newest record, such an amazing voice. And when I hear it, I hear a combination of, you know, certainly standards and jazz, but I also hear, I heard a recording of you doing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay on YouTube.
Oh, no.
And you can hear that, even when you're not singing a straight, you know, soul type tune like that, you can hear an influence of soul. So I just want to learn, you know, at the onset about you musically. You grew up in New Orleans.
Yes.
And I'm just curious about musical influences. What were the, when you think back to your childhood, what was the musical, what was the music that sort of lit the fire for you early on?
Gospel music.
Really?
Singing in church when I was a kid. You know, I went to church almost every Sunday of the year, mm-hmm. you know, with my mom, because she wouldn't miss services.
Sure.
You know. And I heard the choir, you know, I heard the elders of the church, you know, starting off the services in the morning, singing a cappella before the musicians came in, you know. So I grew up hearing that. So that was my first influence.
And do you, so in terms of the environment of the church, did your mother have you sing as a part of the church choir? Was it more as a part of the congregation?
That came later in my teens.
Yeah.
But the very first time I sang, I was, I don't think I was even 8 years old yet. I think I was maybe six or seven years old.
And did you have a musical family?
I did, sort of. Not professional musicians, but my parents sang. And they, you know, I heard them sing in church.
Right.
And I had a much older brother, 14 years older than me.
Okay.
But I heard the three of them at different times sing in church.
And I feel like that's such a gift to a young person. I grew up in a musical household. My parents were professional musicians, but they had gotten out of the Air Force. They were Air Force musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I came along, my mother had gotten out of music. My dad was a music teacher. But my first sort of musical moments were hearing the singing and that willingness to just share and get you to sing.
Yes,
it's such a gift, because
because
something's happening to you before you even have time to think about it. You know,
that's
you're
right.
singing, and it's just
that's
around
right.
you.
Yeah, it affects you, you know, positively.
Yeah.
And you don't forget that growing
right.
up. I mean, it stays with you.
Yeah.
So, and that's been with me ever since, up until today. You know?
Yeah.
And I had no idea I was going to do it for a living.
Right.
But I remember that feeling when the elders of the church gave me a little song to sing, you know, doing a play that they would have the kids do for holidays, for Christmas, Thanksgiving, or Easter. You know, and they gave me a few lines to say and a song to sing. And that was it. You know, I immediately felt so good doing that.
Yeah.
And I had no idea I had the ability, and I wasn't thinking about it at the time. But I remember my parents and my brother singing in church.
Right.
And how much I enjoyed it and felt so proud of seeing them up there.
Do you recall maybe one of the first people? And you know, I want to maybe speak about the Batiste family and Alvin Batiste, but maybe not him. But do you remember one of the first people that sort of let you know, like, hey, you're pretty good at this, or just that when an older, you know, an elder of yours sort of like clued you in that you're not just singing and sounding good, but like you're actually really good. Like, do you remember that as a moment or a person?
Vaguely, the first instance maybe. I'm in my early 20s, probably.
Okay.
I went to a college in New Orleans for a while. I didn't complete my degree, but the music department there and the faculty was amazing.
Mm.
So I got a lot out of that, you know, even though I didn't graduate. But I learned so much from my instructors and the other people around me that were playing instruments and singing and, you know, different styles, you know, classical, jazz, you know, pop, whatever, you know. I got so much out of that. But one of my professors, he was the first one outside of church surrounding, you know, that told me he enjoyed what I did vocally.
Good.
And that was the first time anybody had ever said that to me. So that was the greatest feeling. And this guy, he was, you know, he didn't hand out compliments easily.
Lightly, yeah.
Yeah. So coming from here, and I'll never forget that.
Yeah. Now I understand that also as a young musician, you started with the saxophone or picked up the saxophone as well. Where did that fit in sort of your musical development age-wise? Where were you in that?
That's church too.
Okay.
Well, actually high school.
Okay.
I was hesitant to join a band as much as I wanted to when I started senior high school. Mm-hmm. But a friend of mine in junior high school, who later both of us went to the same senior high school. It was a separation back then because I'm old, you know, but now it's all connected.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
You know, junior went to so many grades and then senior from like 9th to 12th or something like that. But anyway, I watched him play clarinet in a marching band. And I was, man, I would love to, saying to myself, I would love to do that, but I didn't have the courage to even attempt that.
Do you remember how old you were, roughly?
Oh, my God, I was still a teenager.
Okay.
Maybe 17, yeah. So I'm at senior high, and I decide to start playing saxophone. So my daddy got my first saxophone, and I started playing in the high school band. And at that time, I was still pretty active in the church. So I would play services at church with my horn, you know, standing next to the organist, you know, playing my horn and singing, still singing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you feel like with the saxophone, you know, did you feel like a late bloomer in any sense, or did you have a pretty quick uptake
not
to
a
it?
Not a late bloomer, but it didn't take as much as I enjoyed playing. I was never a good player or sight reader.
Sure.
You know, but I tried it for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, but that was my second attempt of something else musically other than vocalizing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you, from what I understand, played the saxophone in the Navy when you went into Navy.
I did band. 7 years. Yeah. Yeah.
So you definitely did it. I mean, you know, it was more than just sort of a side secondary thing.
Yeah. And I was surprised. I surprised myself doing that.
Yeah.
I was surprised they accepted me in the first place. But they did that the last 7 years of my Navy life.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Now I understand that you heard two of the Marsalis brothers, Branford and Winton, early on.
In my high school days.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was, I believe they came with Alvin Batiste.
Yeah.
To your school.
Yeah.
Talk about sort of what was that experience for you? What did that do for you? And of course, as we'll speak about shortly, you know, the relationship with Winton has obviously continued on and well into your current life. But what was that early experience like for you to hear him and to hear those, to hear Alvin and to hear those two brothers?
Oh, the admiration that I had for someone that was my age, you know, or he was younger than me.
Right.
Having that ability, music ability, you know, at such a young age, you know, he's 14, 15 years old. His kid walks in with his big fro, you know, and I can't remember I think Branford was with him. But hearing that was, I can't explain it. It just felt good, you know, something like, this is a musician my age playing like this at this level, you know.
Yeah.
You can't get any better than that.
Right. Do you recall what they were playing? Was it more jazz?
Oh, no. It was jazz. Yeah. And Alvin Batiste was there. He had his clarinet, you know, so.
Yeah. So, you know, I just briefly, since, you know, you grew up in New Orleans, the sound of jazz, you spoke about the gospel roots in your life, but when did jazz come to your life? Was it around that time when you started hearing?
Jazz was much later.
Yeah.
Yeah, jazz was much later. I mean, I played some in school with the college big band. And then when I got into the Navy music program, and this is the late 80s at this time, we had different groups, you know, because the military plays all styles of music. So we had a big band, we had a small group, we played pop music, R&B. So the big band, I got to play a little jazz and sing a little bit. You know, it wasn't the old style American songbooks, you know, kind of jazz. But it was close enough,
yeah.
You know, because the instrumental arrangements were screaming.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So that was my first time actually after such a long break between the 70s and then you going into the late 80s and I get to do it again.
Yeah.
That was my second attempt trying to perform it and hearing it and being there in a group of people that's playing the same thing.
I have to think though that the way you grew up and the place you grew up, it was probably in there ready to come out pretty easily when the opportunity struck.
Yeah, because once it's planted, you know, that's it. It might, if it's there, you know, but you don't get to practice it or perform it, but it's still in you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you look back on your Navy performing days, what are some of the more fond elements of that? Is it the sort of musical diversity, or is there something else that when you look back really kind of, you know, you think back fondly on that experience?
Definitely. You know, it took me to countries that I never thought ever.
So you were you were deployed, or you were at least toured internationally?
Yeah, we toured mostly Asia because I was, my first band was on Guam.
Oh,
so I was
see.
Stationed there for 5 years. And from Guam, we went to, we went to Singapore, China, you know, Philippines. Went to so many places.
Wow.
And that was an experience that I never thought I'd have, you know, in my life. So I think of that fondly. Those days were something I needed,
you know,
and it was definitely beneficial.
As I mentioned, my folks were in the Air Force and they were stationed in Germany, and that's where my brother and I were born. And they spoke about the audiences overseas as some of the most inspiring elements. And you hear, there's sort of a storied, it is storied in jazz history that many musicians would move to Europe because of the warmer reception by those audiences. Do you have any particular memories of a particular audience somewhere that just made you feel particularly special when you performed, or an environment, a venue?
Back then when I was in the military?
Yeah.
We went to mostly Asian countries. Mm-hmm. So that those cultures, they're very quiet, you know, they're not expressive, you know, not in a bad way.
Sure.
But it's just part of how they are.
Yeah, they're
etiquette. So the audiences are, you know, they enjoy you, but they don't necessarily show it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they think if they get too loud, they're insulting you. But I think the best place was Australia. We went to Australia one of my first trips. Went to Philippines and then Australia, and we were there for 7 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the best place as far as audience attendance and the response that they gave us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, when you left the Navy, what was your next sort of professional musical step on your journey from there?
I was just wandering. Well, not really wandering, because
did you move to the West Coast shortly after that, or?
Yeah. Not by choice.
Oh, I see.
When I separated from the military, I had to out-process at Treasure Island. At the time, it was a Navy base there. So I out-processed, and my storage goods were there.
Sure.
Because if you go overseas, they keep your all your belongings and everything, all your properties or whatever, in the U.S.
Right.
And then when you get out, you go to that place, and you're already there with that. Yep. So, I had no plans to go anywhere else.
Gotcha.
I didn't know what to do, so I said, well, I'm here, so I'll just stay here.
And where was here exactly? What?
Oakland.
Oakland, okay.
Yeah. And that was my first time in Northern California. And I've been there ever since.
Yeah.
It's been 28 years this month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you ever think you'd spend that long out on the West Coast?
No. Nope.
Wow.
Not at all.
What has been the element of the West Coast that's sort of kept you inspired and kept you, hooked you, grounded you there, perhaps?
Probably meeting so many musicians along the way, you know, and how welcome they made me feel when I first arrived there and then started going out to open mic nights to different places, mostly in San Francisco. And there's a few clubs that was in Oakland. So, yeah, it's just the musical family that just took me in and made me feel welcome.
When you were getting your let's call them first gigs, you know, as a civilian on the West Coast, were you aiming at certain kinds of work? Were you trying to sing small group standard stuff, or just taking any work that came?
No, not really. Just taking whatever came by. Yeah, I couldn't be choosy.
Sure. Yeah, no, I understand.
Because I had nothing. I started off doing temp agency work, you know.
And making the rent.
Making the rent, paying the bills. And then I had a bass player friend of mine gave me some advice. He said, well, just start going out and sitting in with wherever you can and find out where the clubs are with live music. And
right.
So I started doing that, and things just started building along the way, yeah. Mm.
And then in terms of, did you have a regular, or do you have a regular working group, or do you sing with lots of different sort of rhythm
different
sections?
Different combinations, yeah. Okay. Different combinations, and mostly, well, pretty much all in the Bay Area.
Sure.
Yeah, because it's a lot of fine musicians there.
Yeah.
So put together a combination of whoever's available, you know, drummer, mm-hmm. piano player,
right.
bass.
Yeah. There's a percussionist that I met in graduate school. I went to Indiana for my master's. He was teaching there at the time in the World Percussion Area. His name's Michael Spiro, and he's from the Bay Area. And he just, he's always talked about just the breadth of musicianship out there. And it can be straight ahead swing, but it can also be many different styles and fusions of styles.
Yes.
And so he spent 10 years teaching in Indiana, but he decided, I got to go back. He had a lot more to do in terms of, you know, projects he wanted and to play with people that he had been playing with when he was young.
Sure.
He also grew up with the Tower of Power musicians and, you know, so he was good friends with David Garibaldi, the drummer with Tower of Power. And but he talks, as you do, about just sort of the rich familial element of sort of the Bay Area musicians.
Yes, very much.
Yeah.
Very much.
I want to talk briefly just about your singing style and sort of your interests. As I listened to your recording from 2020, What's the Hurry, one of the things that jumped out to me was the tune Here's to Life. I love that song. And it's one that, you know, really, like Shirley Horn, when she did that recording, was late career, and it was just, it's just such an epic song. I don't know what it is about that song. But, you know, what's your, you know, that tune, how did that tune draw you in? Because when you hear Shirley sing it, it's like, there it is. But you have a way of making it fresh again.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, I was, when I first heard it, the thought of trying to do that, you know, physically.
Right.
I said, no, I'm not going to touch that. That's Shirley Horn.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece of music.
It is.
I'm not going to touch that. But what got me over the top was hearing a dear friend of mine sing it at a live performance. Her name is Faye Carroll.
Okay.
She's a dear friend of mine, and I rarely see her these days. But we performed in the past years together. And I heard her do it at one of her gigs. And I'm saying to myself, oh my gosh. And I, you know, I feel of her as a big sister. Mm. I'm like, man, if my big sis can do this, you know, that just gave me the inspiration to try it.
Yeah. Well, so, it comes through that way. To me, it's one of the sort of, it's one of the tracks on your recording that just sort of sends chills. It's just,
because
the tune is it's such an underperformed, obviously, song, because it's not so much of a standard as,
yes,
you know, some
yes,
of the others.
Yes.
But
yes.
It's just, And also the subject matter,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's lyrically different. It's speaking mm-hmm. of, you know, no complaints, no regrets, all that. The mm-hmm. way that the lyric is written is just so magical
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
But in terms of other tunes, you know, what inspires you? Do you have sort of a sweet spot of songs or song styles that you like to sing? Or do you, you know, Great American Songbook? Or what are some of the sort of repertoire choices that really kind of inspire you at this point?
Repertoire choices. R&B
mm-hmm.
actually came first. Well, gospel and then R&B, and jazz came last.
Yeah.
You know, even though I heard it from the city I grew up in, mm-hmm. you know, it's not that I didn't have any interest in it. I just never tried it back then.
Yeah.
But in that order, gospel, R&B, and the American Songbook now that I've been doing mostly. Yeah.
And when you sing the standard stuff, which I know you're kind of here to do with Columbus Jazz Orchestra, it comes across so swinging and so relaxed. And it certainly, you can hear some of the tone quality and some of the elements of the other styles. Another video that I watched of yours was when you sang the tune, I Didn't Know What Time It Was.
Oh, you saw
another
oh my
amazing
God.
Standard. I saw, I'm like, man, Kenny's singing all these amazing tunes that nobody sings.
Oh, my God.
You know, not nobody, but you know,
yeah,
less
yeah.
common.
Yeah.
And again, just delivered it with just such relaxed
no,
control.
Oh, thank you. It's thank really you. Great. You never know who's listening out there.
That's right. Well, there's some really cool videos of yeah. you on YouTube singing some standards, swinging band on the West Coast. I forget
yeah.
the radio station. Yeah. Oh, okay. NKX did a whole concert in studio there with you, and that's some really cool stuff. Briefly, I want to talk about the Wynton Marsalis sort of modern day relationship. In 2013, you did Blood on the Fields
mm-hmm.
along with Gregory Porter. Someone else was on that with you, Gregory Porter and someone else. I'm blanking right
now.
That
was Paula West.
Paula West, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. And Gregory Porter.
Gregory, yeah. Such another amazing voice.
Oh, my God.
And a contrast to your voice. Like, he's got his own
ooh, yeah,
big
yeah,
Lou
yeah.
Rawls influence.
Exactly. Whatever. Got that low and I got yeah. the high. And, yeah, Paul was right in the middle there.
Right, yeah, exactly. What a cool contrast, the three of you.
It was fun.
Yeah, so yeah. talk about that experience. Had you done some work with Wynton and the Jazz Lincoln Center folks before that, or was that sort of a first?
That was the first. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was the first one, and I was really scared.
What was that? Did the call come from Wynton? Did
well, his people.
Yeah, just
yeah.
Just
he doesn't call you directly.
That's right.
You know, he's got a staff of
sure.
of whatever he needs.
Yeah.
That can get that done.
Yeah, but he had heard you along the way, I'm sure.
The only time I think maybe he had me in mind because we were in the same room together because I was there with a friend of mine, Pat O'Leary. He lives in New York.
Okay.
He got an audition for us, State Department, you know, because they're still doing that now.
Right.
And I had no idea until he called me. You want to do an audition for the State Department? So I went to New York and we did the audition in one of the classrooms similar to this. So I walk in, and then later, Wynton walks in. He's one of the judges, and I had no idea he was going to show up for that.
Wow. Okay.
So I think he remembered me from that time, because this is years later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, years earlier for the audition.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think maybe he remembered me, or one of his staff people told him, you know, you remember that guy from the State Department audition?
Yeah.
I'm just guessing, you know.
Sure.
I don't
sure.
know how it came about, yeah. but somehow he remembered me. And
yeah, you made an impression, for sure. And then
I guess, yeah.
And as we were saying off mic, another one of the Lincoln Center folks and a dear friend of Columbus, Todd Stoll,
mm-hmm.
who I was on the phone with, and he said hello to you. He cites your Frank Sinatra show as the one that really knocked him out. He called you the anti-Frank. Which is kind of funny. You know, what I think he means by that is you came in and did Frank your way.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you didn't feel the need to sort of go into a mold that was sort of a caricature of Frank, but rather to
yeah.
do it your way. And something he said, and I'm curious, he said that you had not performed a lot of that Frank Sinatra music. He
no.
said you were like, that's not
that was
really
my first.
Really?
First time. I mean, I'm a big Frank Sinatra fan.
Of course.
But I never did a whole show.
Yeah.
And some of those guys actually in the band actually played with Frank Sinatra.
Mm.
So a lot of the original arrangements was his. Mm-hmm. So that was the pressure was on.
Yeah. But in this age where, you know, I think as organizations that present concerts, Frank is such a huge draw by name.
Of course.
But yeah, I think it is sort of a brave and necessary move to, like, let's get somebody in here that's going to spin it on its head, do something new, because everyone knows these songs. It's not going to hurt anyone to hear.
Yeah.
In fact, it's inspiring, and it allows that music to live on when it somebody is. Totally yeah. owns it
sure
for
it
themselves.
Is. Sure it is. And it made me dig in and do material that I'd never done before.
Yeah.
You know, because most of the pieces that Frank did, I'd never done before, except for maybe one or two.
Yeah.
But for that gig, it was all his arrangements that you've ever heard on recordings, you know. And it was a challenge, but it was fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Yep. That's a good segue to this concert, Nat King Cole. As I was mentioning, I'll be at the show on Sunday. I haven't had the opportunity to hear it quite yet, but I can't wait to hear it. Did Nat King Cole have sort of a place in your earlier listening, maybe the tunes, or did you have a direct connection to Nat King Cole?
Not really, but of course you hear him along the way.
Right.
But I was... Yeah, I didn't really listen to him,
right?
You know, on purpose.
Sure.
You know, but you once you hear that voice, and his playing ability, it draws you in.
Yep.
You know, so I knew of him and I knew the sound.
Yeah.
So that's immediate. It's just like I'm a fan of Nat King Cole now.
Right.
So need to put him on the list.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Is there a piece on this concert that kind of you're having, you know, particular fun with or enjoying?
One particular? No.
Okay.
I like it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. You can't pick one.
Right. Right.
See, I like this one better. No.
Yeah.
No, I can't do that.
Yeah. It's such a wide span though with Nat King Cole because he had so many hits on ballads.
Exactly.
But then, as you were indicating with the piano playing and his swinging style, he can swing with the best of them. I heard a little clip on our social media of you doing Route 66.
Yeah.
You know, those swingers with Nat King Cole are just as fun as hearing the ballads. So
yes,
it kind of gives you both sides of that coin.
Yes, it is.
So, you know, it's really a pleasure to hear you. We want the rest of the world to hear you beyond this. Hopefully somebody listening...
You.
Here and Columbus maybe can be a new destination for you because we've been so blown away by your talent.
Yep, well, thank you.
And it's and such a warm personality and delivery of this music, and your spirit is really, everybody on the staff and in the band are buzzing about what you've brought this
week.
That's
great. It makes me happy.
So we encourage our listeners to check out the JAG TV recording, JAG.TV, here in a couple of weeks. I believe it's February 23rd. It comes out on JAG TV, so as you're listening to this podcast, probably within the next week. And, you know, for our listeners and audience that follow the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, you know, if you come to this show or you don't, put the name Kenny Washington sort of on your radar. Certainly your album, What's the Hurry, from 2020, is a wonderful sort of piece of that. But we're so thrilled that you're here, Kenny, and thank you for your time
on
this podcast.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
The Jazz Scene is presented by Jazz Arts Group of Columbus, America's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the art of jazz. Our theme music is titled 3/4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was hosted by Zach Compton and produced and engineered by Mercedes Aviles. Subscribe to The Jazz Scene wherever you get your podcasts.